disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest with my help.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs for every bridge that ain't been burned, for every cop car that ain't been turned.
Welcome to This Is America, October 11th, 2021. On today's episode, we dive into headline and resistance news before switching to our discussion, where we offer up an anarchist critique and analysis of Biden's continuing attacks on migrants and the push to expand industrial petrol capitalism. There's a lot to cover, so let's get straight to the news. Canadian fossil fuel company Enbridge directed police to make arrests and carry out surveillance against protesters who fought against the Line 3 pipeline and even picked up the bill for everything from overtime, equipment, meals, and much more, according to an investigation from The Guardian. They write, Enbridge is replacing the Line 3 pipeline from Minnesota to carry oil from Alberta to the tip of Lake Superior in Wisconsin. A report by the climate group MN350 says the expanded pipeline will emit the equivalent greenhouse gases of 50 coal power plants. The project was meant to be completed and start functioning by the end of this week. Police have arrested more than 900 protesters opposing the Line 3 pipeline and its impacts on climate and indigenous rights, according to the Pipeline Legal Action Network. Records obtained by The Guardian show that the company meets daily with police to discuss intelligence gathering and patrols. And when Enbridge wants protesters removed, it calls police or sends letters. Records obtained by The Guardian show the close working relationship between Enbridge and law enforcement. In December of 2020, sheriffs began proactive safety patrols of communities along the pipeline's route. Up to August 6th, the Enbridge account reimbursed the sheriffs hundreds of thousands of dollars for these patrols. New body cam footage from the first days of the George Floyd uprising in Minneapolis show police mocking some demonstrators and seeking others out who were breaking curfew, quote-unquote, firing rubber bullets at them. Police made racially charged remarks, decried the press, and celebrated violent direct hits, quote-unquote, with their rubber bullets. Later, the officers laughed in their vans, talking about attacking anarchists and even imitating the cartoon character Elmer Fudd, joking about hunting them down. A Washington state prosecutor has found, quote, no crime in the state assassination of Portland area activist Michael Reinhall last year, who shot and killed an associate of the far-right group Patriot Prayer after Proud Boys and other fascist gangs flooded into Portland, Oregon, waving Trump flags and attacking people on the street. Reinhall had been a regular at Black Lives Matter protests. In an interview with Vice News right before he was murdered, claimed he acted in self-defense to defend himself and his friend. On social media, Reinhall stated his support for opposing fascism, but there is no evidence that he was involved in any one anti-fascist group. Hours after he conducted the interview with Vice, he was killed in a fatal confrontation by a group of U.S. Marshals and local police as he walked to his car eating gummy worms. Trump would later take credit for the assassination, which was coordinated by the Justice Department. For an in-depth look at the case, check our show notes for links. A new review of over 40 years of data shows the deadly encounters with law enforcement, often when victims are black or brown, have been mislabeled or not reported at all. According to The Guardian, more than half of all police-involved killings in the U.S. go underreported. In the U.S., between the years 1980 and 2018, more than 55% of deaths, over 17,000 in total, from police violence were either misclassified or went underreported. The study also discovered that black Americans are more likely than any other group to die from police violence and are 3.5 times more likely to be killed by police than white Americans. A new look at a DHS document analyzing the department's brutal crackdown of the 2020 George Floyd uprising in Portland shows, according to the Daily Cause, that it was an extraordinary exercise in authoritarian incompetence It demonstrates that senior DHS leadership pushed unfounded conspiracy theories about anti-fascists and anarchists, encouraged the contractors they hired to violate protesters' constitutional rights, and made baseless connections based on no real evidence, also created dossiers on protesters and journalists which they called baseball cards, despite having no clear connections to domestic terrorism or security threats. The DHS internal view found that Chad Wolf and his immediate underlings pushed staffers to describe the protesters as, quote, violent Antifa anarchist-inspired actions, or VAAI, an entirely new category that was created by the state, much like black identity extremists. Finally, the trial of anarchist political prisoner Eric King is set to begin in Denver, Colorado on October 14th. For more information and for updates from Eric's legal team, check out our show notes. In resistance news, in the wake of legal attacks on abortion access, churches in Louisville and Boulder, Colorado were vandalized with pro-abortion graffiti. According to the Washington Times, the messages spray-painted in red, black, and white on the building included the anarchist A, no wire hangers ever, bands off our bodies, Jesus loves abortion, your church is dying, lol, my body, my choice, and no gods, no master. In Iowa City, a group marched by the offices of anti-abortion organization Birthright. Photos posted to Twitter later showed a shattered window at the Birthright offices, with pro-choice signs and coat hangers left on the ground where the windows and doors used to be. In Portland, a radical bloc joined the larger women's march, taking to the streets against attacks on abortion rights. Members of the No Coal, No Gas campaign blockaded the entrance to the New England only remaining coal power plant and used pickaxes to break up the pavement. In Portland, anarchist groups formed a black bloc, taking part in youth-led climate protests. Responding to calls for solidarity with autonomous Zapatista communities under attack by paramilitaries, people held solidarity demonstrations in various cities, including Detroit, Portland, El Paso, Texas, and Seattle. Also in Mexico City, people squatted a dilapidated government office and turned it into a community space in solidarity with the ongoing Zapatista resistance. Family and friends of Guillermo Amarcuza, killed by police on April 10th, clashed with authorities and disrupted a national night out event organized by the police in San Fernando. Angry protests also erupted in Portland after a grand jury decided not to charge police with the killing of Robert Delgado, who was shot and killed by police while carrying a toy gun in a park in Portland, Oregon. According to the Williamette Week, around 9 p.m., the crowd moved to the east side of the Justice Center, where chants against the Portland police continued. All the while, spray paint-wielding teams of black bloc protesters graffitied the building with anti-police slogans, using umbrellas to shield their faces from view. People threw eggs and bottles of water at the building. Demonstrators then marched to City Hall, where the graffiti continued. People tore down an American flag from the city flagpole and burned it on the front door of the building. Smaller bonfires were set on Southwest 4th Avenue facing City Hall, where newspaper boxes were used as barricades in the middle of the street. In New York, protesters hit the streets of the Bronx against the police killing of Mark Rosado, hitting cop cars with eggs and dropping banners. Another demonstration was held for Fantability, an 8-year-old African-American girl who was shot horrifically killed by police in Pennsylvania after officers opened fire on a vehicle following a shooting outside of a football game. Bilti's sister was also tragically injured in the shooting, although she survived. Black Lives Matter activists in Saratoga Springs are pushing back against police attempts to repress the movement by slamming activists with trumped-up charges stemming from months-old protests. Anti-ICE demonstrations continue, with protests taking place at a facility in Plymouth and the home of DHS secretary, whose house was covered in a giant metal blanket. The movement to push cops off campus in California continues, with banner drops happening across the UC Davis campus. Workers in Chicago's Little Village neighborhood staged a walkout at a tortilla production facility to denounce decades-long abuse, low wages, and unsafe working conditions. Carpenters in Seattle also walked off their jobs, forming roving bands of pickets over the past few weeks. from one report. Like other sections of workers, the carpenters are determined to overturn decades of union-backed concessions. They have sought to expand their struggle by calling out non-striking carpenters and other building trades workers. Despite the pandemic, Seattle is experiencing a construction boom driven by the new projects ordered by Amazon, Microsoft, Google, and Facebook. Carpenters who cannot afford to raise a family in the area or keep up with the rising fuel and other costs associated with long daily commutes are calling for a $15 wage increase over 3 years, increased employer contributions to health care and pensions, and fully paid parking. Small groups of carpenters have begun a series of wildcat pickets that they say has slowed or shut down around a dozen additional job sites. The union has been viciously cracking down on these unauthorized quote-unquote actions, deciding to shut down all picket sites and encouraging the rest of the 2,000-strong striking carpenters to turn against the workers involved. Across the U.S., a larger strike wave is currently brewing. As the Inquirer wrote, America has been here before. In 1946, after essential workers who worked long hours and made sacrifices to get the U.S. through a different kind of crisis in World War II, millions of mostly factory workers joined the largest and also one of the most violent strike waves in the nation's history. Despite GOP lawmakers working to impose some restrictions on union power, such as the Taft-Hartley Act, which criminalizes solidarity or general strikes. But the solution to this lies not in politicians or the established union bureaucracy, which has worked to contain class struggle in favor of social peace and funneling dues to the Democratic Party, but instead in expanding strikes and pushing them into larger scale community struggles against capitalism class society as a whole. We have already seen this at play during the mass wildcat strikes of teachers several years ago and in the recent Nabisco strike, where supporters and other groups of workers blockaded and stopped trains, fought with scabs, blocked their buses in an effort to aid the strikers and expand the struggle. Finally, in Mexico, anarchists took part in demonstrations commemorating the 1968 massacre of activists and students by police and military troops. And finally, if you value what's going down as a revolutionary autonomous media resource in times of crisis and you have the means, please go to itsgoingdown.org/shop. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop. You can sign up to donate monthly, give us a one-time donation, or donate through Bitcoin. You can also tell a friend about us, listen to us on the radio, follow us on social media, and also if you enjoy this show, check out other anarchist podcasts on the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. That's going to do it for us today. Enjoy the discussion, and we will see you soon.
Outsiders, this one's for the outsiders. We're nothing but an outsider, and we don't need to take over. Don't send me a seat at your table. No breaking bread with the devil. Sucking air, all you got is fables. For your cares, money, I don't need you. Outsiders.
No bosses, no money.
Okay.
It's not always sunny.
Yep.
These white boys say life's a beach. Let's make tsunamis. The terrorism of daily life. Some competition, a lot of compromise. Back in the day, I feared my time would never come. They called us postmodern, I didn't even know what that was. They called us outsider art, a term I learned as doors slam. All that is solid melts until the day it can be force fed. The game is to be felt, I felt, not sold. So it goes, the best poets on earth probably never read a poem. So I never got a degree and distrust anyone who say they got a monopoly on truth or bring freedom through the barrel of a gun. Keep playing Darwin's game like it's the only one. You can keep your Milton Friedman. We got Kropotkin. I don't believe my eyes. I don't believe in God. I don't believe you when you say you're going hard. They teach you how to kiss rings, how to do what you can to take things. No doubt we could paint the city black. Instead we cross each other out. So many claim to be the boss, but to take it all they are unprepared. Cause power ain't power unless it's shared. Yeah. Power ain't power unless it's shared. Power ain't power unless it's shared.
Outsiders, this one's for the outsiders. We're nothing but an outsider, and we don't need to take over. Don't send me a seat at your table.
What's going on, as always? I'm sure most people listening to this are aware
that there's been some very horrific images that have come across over on the so-called border of the U.S. and Mexico, showing Border Patrol agents essentially using horses as weapons and their reins to basically attack migrants, largely from Haiti, attempting to cross the Rio Grande River and enter from Mexico into the United States. Right now, there was, as a couple days ago, about 15,000 people basically staged in what would be described as a concentration camp under this freeway. And they were locked in these, like, really horrific conditions. There were reports of lack of access to food, water, and basic sanitation. Of course, this is during a pandemic. And people were trying to cross the river and actually go back into Mexico to get food and water and bring it back to the camp. And these Border Patrol agents were using their horses and, like, running at them. There was one instance during this interaction where one of the Border Patrol agents was heard and recorded saying, like, you know, this is why you're from such a shithole, because you use your women to do this, to fight for you, or something like that. Something along those lines. It's kind of hard to understand what they were trying to get across, but obviously it wasn't good. And yeah, it's just a horrific situation. We're going to get into it, looking at the different aspects of it today, what it means about the Biden administration. I think also what it means geopolitically that the U.S. is continuing along this line of, just as Trump did and just as the Democrats have been pushing, to militarize all of the borders, throughout the Americas, as this, you know, wave of migration continues forward, fueled by climate change, fueled by economic inequalities, U.S. imperialism and neoliberalism and so forth. And let's just get into it. What do you want to say about it before we kind of dive into the different pieces?
I think what's being missed in the media reporting about this is very specifically the history of what's going on here and why it's happening the way it is. And to understand that, we have to go back into the 18th century to really grasp sort of what Haiti is and what Haiti represents and sort of the role of Western powers in Haitian history. And so, you know, in the 18th century, there was an uprising, a slave uprising against the French, which was victorious. And it's the only successful slave uprising to ever extract a colonial power from a colony successfully. Now, after that, though, the French, in the peace treaty that was signed, demanded that, you know, the Haitian government pay them for what they considered to be their property that was, quote, taken during the uprising. Now, Haiti is still paying that money back. If you know, what the French did repeatedly was reassess how much that money was based on inflation and keep making the amount go up. And so Haiti has been paying that money back ever since its independence. That, for a lot of its early history, really prevented Haiti from being able to function in a stable way. A lot of the actual economic receipts of the country were going to France. And so now a lot of that money goes to the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And so moving into kind of the latter half of the 20th century, after World War II, specifically after the Cuban Revolution, the United States was trying to establish its hegemony over the Caribbean as a way to prevent the expansion of Cuban communism. As a part of that sort of attempt, as a part of that kind of campaign, there were a number of wars that were sort of fought. We had a conflict in Grenada, things like this, but we very specifically have a number of conflicts happen in Haiti. And generally what happens in those conflicts is that a left-wing elected government will be removed by the United States and a sympathetic government will be put in place. This has happened at least twice since the end of World War II, and actually it's happened twice since the advent of the 1990s. The United States has done this. Every single time this happens, it throws Haiti into a political crisis. It causes civil wars to break out. It causes power factions to compete against each other. And over a long time, over 30 years, and over that period of time being punctuated with really dramatic earthquakes and hurricanes on the island, Haiti has been reduced down to a role of almost economic subservience at this point. So people leave, you know, people leave Haiti, and they leave Haiti especially after disasters. And that's the context that's missing from all of these stories, is just like with people from El Salvador or Honduras that are coming here, their existence as a migrant is directly tied to American activity in the part of the world that they come from. And that often gets entirely missed in these discussions.
One thing I wanted to add in that real quick is that, you know, I'm looking at an article from the Associated Press. This is from 1997, but it's talking about people trying to pressure the Clinton administration to get them to label Haitian products, largely textiles, clothing, and stuff like that, that it was sold in Walmart, Kmart, Sears, and so forth, that was made in Haiti as no sweat. Mm-hmm. So they were trying to basically stamp out sweatshop conditions. And what it's talking about is one of the reasons that the U.S. wanted to keep, you know, communism, so forth, from, like, seeping into Haiti, and they backed all these regimes, is because they wanted to basically use it as a de facto colony, or at least a space that they could utilize as cheap labor for, you know, certain consumer goods. And if you were around during, you know, the period leading up to the demonstrations in Seattle against the WTO, you were certainly privy to a lot of these conversations and organizing around so-called sweatshop labor in the developing world. And this is one great example of how corporations in the United States greatly benefited from workers in places like Haiti that were working in sweatshop conditions and making, you know, poverty wages, while U.S. corporations were enriched and U.S. consumers were buying cheap goods made in sweatshops. But, of course, this is one of the big reasons that the U.S. wanted those conditions in place, is because they wanted a situation in which corporations were making lots of money and people in Haiti, the workers, were, of course, making very little.
Yeah, and this is sort of how the U.S. historically has treated the Caribbean, which is directly a result or kind of an outgrowth of the way that colonial powers from Europe approached the Caribbean. Namely, they approached it as a site of extraction, right? And that's still very much the case. Haiti, as you just said, was marked as sort of a site for cheap labor. That history goes all the way back to the French occupation, where Haiti was a sugar colony. There's some really interesting economic analyses of the transatlantic slave trade that have started sort of happening, where there's this discussion of how the U.S. economy or the colonial economy in what would become the United States kind of functioned. And the way that it really worked was that products would be produced in the North, sent South, and used in the South, or used in factories in the North, or purchased in the North. In the South, they would use that equipment like cotton gins and things, along with slave labor, to produce goods to export. They would export those goods to the Caribbean first, and in exchange get things like sugar, right? This is how trade worked. And so American history is deeply, deeply tied to slavery and exploitation in the Caribbean. And again, that's still the case. You look at most of the Caribbean currently, and in most of the Caribbean, the primary industry is tourism. And that tourist industry is owned primarily by Americans, and most of the patrons are Americans, right? The other industry that is really, really big in that region of the world is finance, but sort of shady finance, like hiding wealthy white Westerners' money places to avoid taxes. And that in itself also has a really heavily distorting effect on social and political dynamics. So still, even to this day, that is still the relationship that we have to that part of the world, right? And Haiti very specifically. So again, I mean, this is not the first time we have seen a migrant crisis in relation to Haiti. We saw one in the mid-1990s as well, where people were coming over from Haiti on handmade boats and landing in Florida. This kind of corresponded a bit with the Cuban boat lift, which happened sort of around the same time. But Haitian migrants were showing up in Florida that way. It seems like what's happened is that some Haitian migrants and some Haitian refugees are still trying to show up that way. A lot of them have started taking this alternate route through Mexico. And that's kind of how we end up where we are today. So the reason that route exists is, you know, we look at the way that, say, the Italian government under Mario Salvati was dealing with boats of refugees, where they were kind of abandoning them out in the Mediterranean and hoping that they sank. That's roughly what the U.S. was doing to Haitian migrants in the 90s. And so there's a really good reason why lots of people that feel the need to leave Haiti do not want to cross into the U.S. over water. There is a long, long, very violent history of the Coast Guard doing things to prevent migrants from landing and those boats sinking and lots of people dying. And so this seems to be, at least superficially, a safer route. And that seems to be why more people are taking it. The tragedy, though, is that they land in Mexico, they march up to the border, and then they cross. And they're doing all of that because of the economic conditions caused by American brutality in Haiti. And they cross the border and they're immediately met with American brutality the second they cross, right? This is the real tragedy of what's going on here, right? Just like with the migrant caravans, like we are creating a crisis and then we are punishing the people that have to live through the crisis. It's entirely messed up.
Yeah, and there's just so many factors that have pushed and displaced people. You know, as you mentioned, there's just been a series of U.S. involvement in Haiti from, you know, the military literally, you know, going onto the island, the U.S. supporting various coups. You know, most recently there was the assassination of the Haitian president just a couple months ago that led to just increased destabilization. There's just been not only attempts at revolt and people trying to basically push out the corrupted regime, but also there's just been massive amounts of just street fighting between various like criminal factions and the state. It just led to increased destabilization. Just, you know, people report, you know, like the schools not working, people not being able to get food and basic necessities. In 2010, which kind of created sort of like the wave of corruption that we see today, there was a massive earthquake there. And, you know, a lot of money flowed in for disaster relief, and a lot of that money was basically taken up by corrupt politicians, which kind of led to the intensity of the anger at the current regime that we see today. But a lot of people fled Haiti in 2010, and they, you know, they immigrated largely to places like Brazil and Chile. A lot of people ended up working in Brazil for the 2016 Olympics, but those are now over. And also in a lot of countries, like I was listening to, there's an interview with somebody from the Miami Times on Democracy Now talking about kind of the recent history. And they were saying like in countries like, you know, Chile, there's like 1% black population there. So, I mean, a lot of Latin American countries, people found it harder to kind of like settle and get jobs and create a life for themselves. So there's been this constant kind of like shifting around and people trying to find a place to be. And in Brazil, it looks, you know, they found some areas that they could work, but now that work is over. And people have now tried to get into the United States. I think the current numbers that we saw was about like 15,000 people that were in the initial area. And then now, of course, that's gone down because people are starting to be deported. But you know, like I already said, I think it's important to mention a lot of the people that are being deported with small kids, like those kids have never even stepped foot in Haiti. They're not even Haitian born. So, I mean, they're literally just taking people and they're just like dropping them off, you know, Port-au-Prince, which is the capital. And people are just sort of like left fend for themselves. And a lot of people are saying like, we'd rather die than go back. And it's a very tragic situation. One thing I'll point out before we kind of get into other stuff is that the Biden administration is using this Trump era law called Title 42, which is something that Stephen Miller pushed. And of course, you know, we've talked about Stephen Miller on this show. He's somebody that went to Duke University alongside Richard Spencer, was involved in like setting up talks with like white national speakers, like the guy from VDare, Peter Brimlow. In the lead up to the 2016 election, he was working with people at Breitbart, pushing various white nationalist texts, like stuff from American Renaissance and VDare. He is very much a white nationalist, nativist. But, they basically used, this law called Title 42, which is a provision that states that, that migrants pose a unique health risk and the United States needs to basically expedite, removal of migrants during the pandemic. So Biden is continuing to use that law. And what's ironic about that is a lot of people pointed out that these mass deportations of people that, you know, have no access to healthcare, you know, they're in like the most horrific conditions without basic sanitation. They are literally helping to spread COVID at a much larger pace to lots of different places at once through these mass deportations than they are in containing it or helping to stop the spread. And I find it ironic that Biden has branded himself kind of as this administration of science and, you know, against COVID denialism and conspiracy theories. But yet they are essentially doubling down on using that excuse to basically justify policies that were literally set in place by a white nationalist for a very anti-black agenda of stopping people from applying for asylum. And as you remember, I mean, it's supposed to be that people are legally allowed to apply for asylum in the United States if they're fleeing political persecution or disasters. And in fact, this is something that Miller specifically wanted to attack and used, you know, white supremacist texts like, what was that book? Like Battle of the Saints or
Battle of the Saints. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he said, he stated that one of their goals was to explicitly attack people applying for asylum if and when, you know, they were coming in, trying to come into the United States, in the aftermath of, you know, horrific natural disasters. For instance, I don't know if you remember, but a couple years ago, the Bahamas got hit, I think around the same time that Puerto Rico really got slammed by, it was either Hurricane Irma or Maria, but very quickly, the Trump administration moved to block people from coming into the country for, you know, like a couple months so they could get their stuff together and then go back. And this is very clearly a racist move to block people from the Bahamas, which was largely black, from coming into the United States because of the white supremacist ideology that Stephen Miller and other people within the Trump administration were backing. And this Biden is continuing that. And I, as we were talking before that, I think the question right now that we have, and I think we've already answered it, but, you know, why is that? What does Biden have to gain from that? And I think that the answer is that, as we've talked about, the Democrats have cultivated, or attempted to cultivate a relationship with basically subsuming a lot of the Republican base that is not basically tied with Trumpism, but they still are kind of revulsed by the idea of, you know, potentially thousands of black Haitians coming into the United States. And I think that they see this as a very problematic for them, and they don't want to be branded as sort of this open borders, great replacement Democrats. They want to be seen as somebody that's tough on crime, tough on immigration, and this is their way to double down on that. And I think the people that lose, of course, are the people that are the most vulnerable, who that they've, like, you know, spent years in the lead up to the 2016 election branding themselves as kind of the savior of.
Yeah, well, and we see this approach in a lot of things. I mean, we're watching them drift to the center on things like counterterrorism. We've been talking about this since January. You're watching them do this with things like the debt ceiling, right? Which we're not going to talk about in any kind of depth tonight, but essentially what's going on there is, you know, Democrats don't want to own making the deficit bigger. Republicans don't want to own making the deficit bigger, but the deficit has to get bigger. Otherwise, the U.S. government defaults on its debt and crashes the global economy. And so what's resulted from that is gridlock. And it's this process in which both parties at this point are trying to be politicians without having accountability for what they do, where they're sort of trying to do things, but make it look like they're doing as little as possible. And they're not trying to own anything. And so with this, we have this kind of push to the middle on immigration questions, right? This sort of attempt to internalize, I mean, for lack of a better term, internalize the xenophobia of the Republican Party, right? Which is really what this is. I mean, like, if you look up xenophobia in a dictionary, one of the examples that it will give is saying that people who are foreigners are carrying disease. Like, this is a classic xenophobic trope from, you know, 200 years ago that gets often repeated at times when people want to do things that might be pretty racist, but don't want to say that they're doing things that might be pretty racist. That is very much what's happening here. The administration does not want to look like it's, quote, soft on immigration. They don't want to be the party of, quote, amnesty. So instead, what they're doing is they're trying to take on the mantle of the party of cruelty. And we have to really phrase this for what it is. I mean, this is cruel. This is cruelty. Like, we are taking people who already are coming from one of the poorest regions on earth, right? Haiti as a country has one of the lowest median incomes of any country on earth. So we're already talking about people who are, for the, by and large, mostly, extremely deprived. The reason they are deprived is because of the effects of Western colonialism. And then a disaster happens, and instead of being willing to say, cool, we can help you, instead the administration's going, go back to the place where you're deprived, but now there's also a disaster, good luck. Right? That's cruelty. And the Trump administration did a lot of things. One of the things that they did most effectively was they pushed right-wing politics into this realm of cruelty entirely. It was no longer about being right. It was no longer about even making a point. It was about being as cruel as possible to people that you don't like. And the Biden administration picking up this policy means that they are also continuing that cruelty, and doing it willingly. They know, because statistically, every study has shown this, they know that by allowing migrants into the country, you do not increase the risk of COVID, right? That's been shown literally in every single study that has ever been done about migrants and disease, is that migrants do not increase disease levels anywhere, right? So therefore, the argument is entirely xenophobic, right? There's not even a grounding in anything that could even be considered pseudoscience, right? This is really where the administration is kind of embracing Stephen Miller, because Stephen Miller also didn't bother making arguments for stuff. All he did was find the right language to exploit the loopholes they needed to exploit to get done what he had already decided he was going to do. What the Biden administration is doing at this point is they're essentially sanctioning that approach. And they're saying that this is okay as long as we can gain a couple voters. Anybody that is a supporter of Joe Biden at this point, I think, really needs to take a heavy look at themselves. It is pretty difficult to consider yourself a good moral person in the world while supporting an administration that does stuff like this.
So I think on the other hand, I think the question is, like, what do we do with this? Because I think a lot of people right now are looking at those images, and including Biden has even come out and said, like, oh, this looks bad. And I think a lot of people now are admitting this looks terrible. I mean, the images of a white Border Patrol agent basically with a whip running after black, you know, migrants carrying food to their families. I mean, literally, I mean, the first thing I thought of is the KRS-One song. Police, as we know, evolved from slave overseers into what we have today. And this is a very good example, as lots of memes on social media will tell you. But I think the question is like, so what happens to people that are seeing this? And for a lot of people, this might be a very large break with them, with the regime, just like, I don't know, Oscar Grant was with Obama, or the Ferguson uprising was back in 2014. Yes. So I think we should ask ourselves as anarchists is that, you know, in this situation, what do we do with this moment when people are collectively saying, like, yes, this is fucked up?
Yeah, I mean, this is the time to get back out and do stuff, right? I mean, we're watching a process that took 8 years in the Obama administration to really happen, or most of 8 years to really happen, where people finally got fed up with it. Finally, we're done with it. I remember early on in the Obama administration, anarchists were the only people out in the streets anymore. Like, everyone else went home. Like, all these socialist groups out there now, they're talking about how long they've engaged in resistance. That's all bullshit. Like, 2008 through 2014, they were gone. Like, didn't even show up, didn't organize crap, like, nothing. Like, they were gone. So were all the liberals, too. Which shows you how much you can rely on people like that. Which shows you how truthful they are when they portray their activity. But the reality is that we were able to grow and do things in that period of time. But our ability to actually leverage power was pretty minimal for a lot of that period. And we were able to increase that capacity to the point where we could shut whole cities down and things. And did do that on a couple of occasions. But with that said, that's not going to stop Border Patrol from deporting Haitians. And to be perfectly honest, there's relatively little that it seems like can happen in the next 10 days to prevent this from going on. What we can do is we can increase the political cost of this. So unlike the Obama administration, we need to make sure that it does not take 6 years for a bunch of people to get back out in the streets again and join us, right? We need to make sure that we are out in the streets doing stuff, pushing things, and bringing other people along with us, right? The energy is different today than it was at the beginning of the Obama administration. The energy is a lot more heightened. It's a lot more tense. There's much more of a conflictual relationship with the state than there was during this period in the Obama administration. And all of that means that this could play out differently. Now, what that means, though, is an aggregate effect, right? The Biden administration is going to continue to do things like this. They're going to continue to try and pass counterterrorism legislation. They're going to continue to try and push offshore oil drilling. They're going to continue to try and push global hegemony for the United States internationally. They're going to continue to push anti-immigrant and anti-black policies. Like, we know this, right? The only way that that stops is not even necessarily getting rid of this regime. It's about building up the inertia of resistance to the point where things like this can't happen anymore. That's a long fight. That's a long struggle. But it all starts now, right? What we cannot do, and this should be the big wake-up call for people, right? This should be the thing that people wake up and look at it and go, oh, crap, this isn't all that different. We should really be trying as hard as possible to break this kind of spell that Biden has been able to cast over a lot of people. That the fact that he is not Donald Trump has made him magical to a good part of the American population. We need to show people, we need to point out that this is happening and this is what this means.
I mean, literally, like, you know, if you want a good example of this, Biden just went to the UN and gave a speech and basically tried to separate himself from, you know, the politics of Trump and said, you know, we will be an administration that is on the side of, you know, truth and science and the peaceful protesters and the whistleblowers and, you know, basically all these kind of good things that most people can agree with or something like that, or, you know, especially like liberals and even a lot of progressives. And, you know, again, like to a lot of people, this sounds good. This sounds like progress. Mm-hmm. But then when you look at something like this where it matters, I think, you know, the situation becomes a lot more darker and you see this as a continuation of, you know, an industrial civilization that's heading in one direction. And like we said before, I mean, in a lot of ways, the Democrats are much more scary because, like, at least in terms of like border policy, I mean, they want things like smart borders and like, you know, massive state surveillance. I mean, as opposed to just this like crappy border wall that people can literally slip in between the slats. Or they can like weld off or something like that. You know, I think like there's a real line that you can draw between Biden's policies in the 1990s that were designed to militarize the police, build up this massive apparatus of mass incarceration and militarization around the war on drugs, to what we're seeing now is that, you know, in the 90s, I mean, as people have argued using the language of like surplus populations and stuff like that, the state needed somewhere to put a lot of people.
Yeah.
And their solution, of course, was to put them in prison and to monetize that and to control people that way, to basically turn whole communities into open air prisons. And I think that they're doing much the same thing in today's world. And one of the things that Trump, did that they're continuing is they're basically establishing the militarization of borders in other states as well, connected to what's going on in the United States. They're making people apply for asylum in different countries. They're militarizing borders in different countries. You know, they're making Mexico set up like a whole new police force to like monitor migrants. You know, there were just clashes with the Mexican authorities, with migrant caravans the last couple weeks. You know, we're seeing everything we're seeing at the border right now in the United States. So, and they know what's coming too, which is massive waves of migration. This isn't going to stop anytime soon. So they want to beef up their security apparatus now. So when this, you know, gets even more intense, they'll have systems in place to deal with this. In fact, there was just an article that came out where they said, that DHS is scrambling to deal with the surge of migrants. And right now they're seeking a private contractor to operate a migrant detention facility at the U.S. base in Guantanamo Bay, with the requirement that some of the guards speak Spanish and Haitian Creole, according to government records, which is, to me, incredible. Which, ironically, again, what's the one thing that Obama said he was going to shut down was Guantanamo Bay. And here it is.
Guantanamo Bay. Yep. And here we are. Right. I mean, this is the thing. You know, like, not only do we have to look at this situation with Haitian migrants through the lens of American and Haitian history, we also need to look at this through the lens of the history of Joe Biden, which not only involves the continual decades-long advocacy for the growth of mass incarceration, but also includes a long, decades-long legacy of trying to militarize the border, right? Like, Biden was involved when he was a senator with trying to negotiate the bipartisan immigration deal under George W. Bush, which would have militarized the border, built a gigantic wall, stuck cameras everywhere, and started to set up, I mean, drone technology was pretty rudimentary compared to now, but started to set up the idea that they were going to use, you know, unmanned aircraft on the border to monitor border conditions. That those bills would have increased the size of the Border Patrol really dramatically. They would have increased the funding for Border Patrol really dramatically. They would have limited the pathways of migrants coming in. Like, all of the stuff that's happening right now, a lot of the same policies that liberals were aghast about under the Trump administration are things which, I mean, the border wall has a very specific route. But outside of that, a lot of the other immigration policies, though more severe under the Trump administration, the foundations for those were laid under George W. Bush. And the primary Democrat involved in those bipartisan negotiations was Joe Biden, right? So, I mean, this is not a new thing for him, right? I think that there was this delusion that took over when he got into office that things were so different, like markedly, notably different, and that everything's really boring now. And everything is kind of boring now, like much more so than before. But it's really not all that different. Like, at the end of the day, the fundamentals are still the same. There's still a state that has sovereignty that uses police to impose that sovereignty, and a border that they then police, right? And when we combine that with all of the history of the U.S. and Haiti, and when we combine that with the long history of racism and colonialism in this country, it's not particularly surprising that a politician like Joe Biden takes this kind of approach, but it is still unconscionable. Like, it is not something that is in any way able to be justified by anybody.
Well, I think what happened is people got caught up in the fact that the Democrats, in the face of, you know, rising anger in the streets, and also the popularity of people like Bernie Sanders, to some degree, they had to kind of paint themselves as progressives. Mm-hmm. Like, as we pointed out, they had to basically paint themselves as people opposed to the very policies that they helped enact, you know, suddenly we're against the neoliberal economy that we've been pushing these last couple decades. You know, suddenly we're against mass incarceration, militarized police that we put forward. Suddenly we're against, you know, the militarization of the border and so on and so forth, which of course they were not, but they basically had to paint themselves, you know, as these sort of like social democrat progressives or light versions of, to basically, you know, pallet themselves to the masses of people. And of course, now that Biden's in office, like, so much of that stuff is out the window. Like, I was just listening to Chris Hedges give a talk, and I mean, sucks in some ways, but I mean, he pointed out correctly that, like, so much of the stuff that Biden talked about is now really out the window. Like, you know, where is student debt relief? Where is the fight for 15? I mean, which, again, as we've said a million times on this show, like, that was a poverty wage 10 years ago when they were first talking about it. You know, all this stuff, which, you know, was kind of like the part and parcel. I mean, even talk of, like, you know, single payer health option, like, all of these things that were sort of the baseline Democratic presentation are just now, of course, totally out the window. But of course, people have, you know, largely forgotten about that. And of course, a lot of the social movements have become deflated because a lot of liberals and progressives are staying home and they're out of the streets. But I think the silver lining for this is that people's consciousness has been moved very, very much so. And then I think people are at a point now where they can see the bullshit and they can see essentially, you know, like, not only kind of like what they want is, but they can see just like how this is just a continuation of what was going on before. And I think our role is to really help people solidify that in their heads and to really make that break. with political parties in general, and to really solidify the role of social movements. And that is the vehicle for change. And that actually allows us to segue into our next segment, which there's been this really interesting report that's come out. It's called Indigenous Resistance Against Carbon. And it lays out the massive impact that Native-led resistance to different fossil fuel projects has been in the U.S. and Canada. And they're saying over the last year, there's been a 25% reduction in emissions because of these Native-led resistance movements, which in itself is massive. If you talk about, you know, 25% reduction because of resistance movements, I mean, that's a huge impact. And I think this is interesting, too, because at this moment, Biden is talking about expanding offshore drilling right now. And also, too, the Democrats are getting hounded, especially in the Midwest, over the Line 3 pipeline, which is getting closer and closer to potentially being finished. Like, there was actually just this funny video with, I'm sure you remember, Amy Klobuchar or something
Amy Klobuchar,
Yeah, and some protesters confronted her outside of her house and were just like, you know, where are you at on Line 3? Like, you've got to come out and oppose it. And she did this whole apologist thing, like, you know, she's literally, like, walking to her car or something, and she gets confronted, and she's like, oh, I've got to get on my phone and make a call. She's like, such, you know, such worms, you know, they can't even have a position on something. Anyway, but, yeah, again, like, the Biden administration, which has branded itself as sort of this, you know, fighter against climate change, is now taking this position. They want to expand offshore drilling. And they've even, because a lot of people have pointed to the recent piece that came out. It was like the Inter Commission report on climate change. We talked about it recently, but basically saying like things are bad and they're even more worse than we thought they were a couple years ago. We've got to make changes in the next like 8 years or so. And the Biden administration literally said, like, well, we don't think that that means that we should stop offshore drilling at all. We're just going to continue forward. So again, like, you know, where is the difference? What is the difference between, you know, the Trump administration who says it out loud and the Biden administration who basically only says it when push comes to shove? And at the same time as they're expanding offshore drilling is like holding UN meetings about attacking climate change. It seems very obvious that they're putting on this sort of like for show, you know, very optic based things where they're, you know, pointing towards one direction and of course doing something else, you know, for industry. And again, like under what administration did we see the massive military buildup to smash Native movements in Standing Rock? You know, this huge coming together of state, corporate, and military might against, you know, this very popular social movement. I mean, that was under Obama, where Biden was the vice president. And now with the fight against Line 3, we're literally seeing police being paid in overtime and even getting weapons from fossil fuel companies. Which are involved in trying to stop resistance to Line 3. So, I mean, again, it's just like the same stuff playing out.
Yeah, and so, you know, you asked the question earlier, what's the difference? The reality is that there is a difference, but it results in the same conclusion. The difference is that for the Trump administration, oil extraction was good in itself. And it was good because it made environmentalists mad. Right. Like literally the entire theme of the Trump administration was make people that don't like me mad. Right. And that did. That was very successful in making people mad. It also did not, his approaches did not actually increase domestic energy production that dramatically, even though they opened up the Alaskan Wildlife Nature Reserve and all this other kind of stuff to oil drilling. So with the Biden administration, the reason is slightly different. And to understand this, and more insidious in a lot of ways, to understand this, we have to go back to, again, the George W. Bush administration, right? Like, there's been a lot of these allusions to the Bush administration, I think, ever since kind of the pullout from Afghanistan started. But I think a lot of that also has to do with the fact that the tail of a lot of these things that the Biden administration is doing really do start there. And in this case, a lot of that started around a discussion of what they refer to as domestic energy independence, right? So I'm sure anyone that's ever watched a presidential debate in the last 15 years has probably heard a candidate say domestic energy independence. But what does that mean? So essentially what that means is that under this concept, we would produce the energy that we use domestically inside the United States. And that includes both, you know, coal and, you know, oil-based gasolines, natural gas, things like this, right? We produce all of that domestically. Now, very obviously, that's killing the planet. And Democrats can't say it's not killing the planet. But at the same time, they have this attachment to energy extraction. And a lot of that has to do with their connections to the fossil fuel industry, right? And all of these people have really well-documented connections to the fossil fuel industry. So the way that they make this argument, and this is fascinating because they've been making this argument ever since the early 1970s, Democrats have. They say, oh, well, we know in the 70s it was global warming. Now it's referred to as climate change. But they're like, we know that belching a bunch of like toxic smoke into the atmosphere is probably a bad thing. We know that. And we want a future where that's not true, right? Which is what they have to say to their base. But at the same time, they want to have, quote, bridge fuels to the future. Now, what that means, what that meant in the 70s was they would say, okay, well, we're looking forward to a solar future, but we have to have coal-fired power plants until we get there. In the mid-2000s, it was, yeah, we're going to try and have electric cars and stuff, but we really need gasoline power cars to get there. Or we really want buses to run in cities, and we won't use gasoline for those because it's really dirty, but we'll use natural gas instead, which still produces a ton of pollution, right? And then when they're pressed on that, they go, yeah, but we don't have reliable electric buses yet, which is a lie. We need this bridge fuel, okay? This is where that push for offshore oil drilling is coming from. This also happened under Obama. So, like, there's this pretty constant push that has been happening ever since the 1970s, ever since the idea that we could just consume as much as we want and pollute as much as we want started to actually have effects, which was in the 1970s, like notable effects that people started to consider to be catastrophic. Pretty much at that point, the energy industry got very, very, very active in politics in DC. The idea of bridge fuels is something which comes from the energy industry. It's a line which comes from their lobbyists and their, quote, think tanks that have argued for years and years and years that we need bridge fuels. But ironically, they've been making this argument for 50 years. 50 years. They've been saying we need 10 years of bridge fuel for 50 years. So very obviously, if we needed 10 years of bridge fuel, we would have been past that by now if they were serious about that, but they're not. And so there's this kind of push and pull where on one hand, again, you know, we were talking about this with migrants, but the Biden administration is trying to appeal to the center. And in the center, this argument of bridge fuels has actually become pretty widely held, even though there's absolutely zero evidence for its veracity. And so in playing to that center, they're opening up oil drilling. That is also a play to their campaign donors. Now, what does that all mean, right? Because patently it's absurd, right? We cannot say we have 8 years left to be able to, you know, prevent catastrophic climate change, but we need 10 years of fuel to get to that point. Like it's the math doesn't work. It's mathematically ridiculous. And so again, Biden supporters really need to ask themselves this basic question, right? If the administration was so serious about combating climate change, why would they be increasing oil drilling, right? If they were actually serious about pushing for a carbon-free future, why would they be encouraging the building of oil pipelines? Why would they be encouraging hydrofracking, right? Joe Biden very specifically during the presidential campaign came out and said that he was supportive of hydrofracking. Why would they continue a process which poisons the groundwater demonstrably? Why? The only reason that I can think of, the only thing there's any evidence for, it's not that these are stupid people. They're not. Most politicians in DC are relatively intelligent. Most. Not all. Louis Gohmert, I have my questions about. But a lot of the rest of them are relatively intelligent. Even people like Ted Cruz, right? Josh Hawley, they're very, very smart people. A complete piece of human garbage, but smart nonetheless. So it could be that all these smart people, for some reason, just ignore this very basic problem. But I don't think that's it. I think what's happening, again, is just like migrants from Haiti, right? Just like civil liberties in the debate around counterterrorism laws. Just like this kind of expansion of the surveillance state, right? All of this are sacrifices that are being imposed by the administration on the rest of us to gain political points in a political center, which in all reality doesn't really exist, right? It's not that Americans, and there have been plenty of studies done about this, it's not like Americans exist in a political continuum cleanly from progressives to conservatives. That in reality, lots of people hold a lot of different positions. And then you've got people like us who don't fall into any of those categories, right? And there's a lot of people like that. But there's plenty of people, for example, who are completely against gun control, but were totally supportive of gay marriage and are completely pro-choice, right? That is absolutely a position that was even a position that had a space in the Republican Party all the way through the mid-1990s, okay? That's like, it was a common position, common like economic libertarian position. So it's not like there's a center that you can identify as having a coherent political position that you can then play to. What they call the center are people who don't identify with either political party. But then the Democratic Party assumes their politics. And that's wrong. People don't like either political party for a lot of very, very good reasons, some of which are relatively core reasons, like myself, right? Some of them are relatively practical reasons, like, you know, a lot of the people I know that really don't have any attachment to either political party and think both of them are slowly killing us. So what they're doing is they're sacrificing us. They're sacrificing social spending. They're sacrificing coronavirus subsidies. They're sacrificing Haitian migrants. They're sacrificing our environment to play to a political center which doesn't even exist. And so we have to start asking ourselves the question, you know, a lot of us got very, very alarmed and active and mobile during the Trump administration because we saw a lot of the awfulness and the cruelty that was happening. And continues to happen in those circles. But what are we seeing now from the Biden administration? We're seeing lies, right? They promised to not deport people making asylum claims for like the first 6 months of the administration. That was a bold-faced lie, right? They claim to want to push for student loan relief. Bold-faced lie. They wanted to push for single-payer healthcare in some form. Bold-faced lie, right? They never had any intention of doing any of those things. And that's very, very, very obvious, right? They were playing people. They were playing people to try and get them to vote for them. Because the Biden administration, we talked about this last fall, has a very core problem, which is that there are not many Joe Biden supporters. There are a lot of people that don't like Donald Trump. There are not a lot of people that like Joe Biden. And that's fine to get elected the first time. But to win midterm elections and to get elected a second time, that's not good enough. And they have to try and convince people to support them. So they lied to us. Like right to your face. Anyone that came to support Joe Biden in this process, as opposed to just begrudgingly recognizing he was not Donald Trump, they lied to you. Right to your face. And that those lies carry with them deep-seated, deeply embedded dynamics of cruelty, which were expressed in the Trump administration, and were expressed in the Obama administration, and were expressed in the Bush administration, right? That on that level, very little has actually changed. That we are still in a position in which the political class of this country is marching us headlong in a death march off a cliff. And really, it's up to us to decide to do something about that. We shouldn't let the fact that the person who's in office, the fact that he wears a blue tie instead of a red one, stop people from doing stuff. That the reality is that the situation has not improved. That it has gotten nicer to hear about, but it has not changed in any kind of notable way. And for those people that were willing to give Joe Biden a bit of a pass for a period of time, y'all need to recognize that time is over, right? If that's what you're trying to do, that time is over. Like the time that the administration six border patrol on a bunch of Haitian migrants who are escaping a natural disaster, that time of giving them latitude is over. And the only thing left for us to do now is to make sure that we don't make the same mistake that a lot of people made during the Obama administration. That instead of going home and then trying to frantically build momentum when things were happening, we need to keep the momentum from last year moving. And we need to not let that degrade, because though the person in the White House is different, the fight still continues. Very little has changed.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.